Obviously, Srila Prabhupada was empowered to do something that nobody else had ever done. I mean, there's no one else who's done something like that. And I'd like us to think in two terms. What were the obstacles that Srila Prabhupada had to overcome? And what was really unique about his accomplishments? Now, before we do this, I'd like to have a little kind of caveat that sometimes when we glorify Srila Prabhupada, we get in this mood if Prabhupada was the best means that other people are less. So I don't want to imply that, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur or Bhaktisiddhanta or Narada Muni are lesser Vaishnavas. That's not the point. I mean, the fact that Srila Prabhupada was empowered in a unique way and did something that we don't even have any history of in the scriptures does not denigrate anybody else. That's not the point. But it is a fact that Srila Prabhupada is empowered in a very unique way. I mean, there simply is no other history of anybody doing anything like what he did. I mean, there just isn't. So, again, that doesn't mean that, you know, he's better than Narada Muni. It's not like that. I mean, in spiritual life, we read in the third canto about the Vaikuntha planets, and it's very clearly explained that everyone there is a devotee. You know, the trees, the flowers, they're all devotees, and in one sense, they're all one. They're all equal in Krishna's eyes. Like Prabhupada says that Krishna is embracing the cow and he's embracing Radharani. So in one sense, it's all one. I mean, we can say the gopis are more intimate than the cowherd boys. But if we start thinking that the cowherd boys are lower, then that's an offense. Is that clear? I mean, sometimes we get into this kind of mentality, you know. Even sometimes within ISKCON, this, you know, my guru is better than your guru and this sort of thing. So it shouldn't be like that. And if we glorify Srila Prabhupada with the mood of denigrating other Vaishnavas, then Krishna will not be pleased. So Krishna is very pleased when we glorify Vaishnavas, but that should increase our glorification of Vaishnavas in general. In fact, many times, Prabhupada, when explaining the first offense, blaspheming devotees who've dedicated their life for propagating the holy name of the Lord, he would explain that in terms of don't denigrate Jesus Christ and Muhammad. That although their preaching was on a lower level of God consciousness, still we shouldn't criticize. So I want to add that little. I really liked this in the first morning's class where he was talking about that many times religious systems want to push their brand of religion by putting down everyone else. So that's not necessary. What we have is so wonderful. We don't need to denigrate anybody. Having said that. I mean, Oxford and Harvard and the Sorbonne, they don't have to criticize Podunk you, you know? They're wonderful institutions, and if someone else is offering something else somewhere else, that's... Do you understand? And sometimes there's wonderful professors even in other institutions. So I'd like us to look first at what kind of obstacles did Srila Prabhupada have to overcome. Poor health and age. Poor health and age. Yes. No money. I mean none. Absolutely none. Right? Yes. Foreign culture to the West. That's a lot bigger obstacle than we might imagine. And many people thought that was completely impossible. Yes. Unsupport. No support from his background organization. And Prabhupada, you know, he kept writing letters. I mean, one of his god-nephews makes a big deal over the fact that he said, I think in Mridanga in some cartels, you know, I was Prabhupada's follower, I sent some musical instruments. But he really got no support. I mean, he had one godbrother before he left India who said, I think it's a good idea. But that was all. I mean, he had no institutional support at all. And even they criticized him. And after Srila Prabhupada was successful, they criticized him even more. The more he was successful, the more they criticized him. They sent him no money. They sent him no manpower. And when he was successful, they criticized him and they wouldn't work with him. Okay, other obstacles. I mean, most people with that would have given up. Just with that would have given up. Yes. Unsteady followers. You're talking about me, right? Okay, yes?
In the beginning, he doesn't have any facility. He must stay in some crowd.
No facility. I mean, really, he had no place to stay. To stay just in a YMCA or at some non-devotee's house or in an impersonalist yoga ashram, in a Bowery loft. No money, no place to stay, no support from your parent organization. He didn't really even have any support here in America. I mean, one Indian gentleman's son who was basically westernized. What? Right, to get legal. Yes. Right. From a high moral background to a low moral society. Excuse me? A philosophy that was unknown in the West. Yes. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Manuscript stolen. That's going to be covered in the tomorrow's house. That to me was, I mean, I would have given up for that. I'm a writer, you know, and the thought of some, I would have just said, Krishna, forget it. If that happened. I'm quitting now. I don't know how he went on after that. Yes? Right? Never been to foreign countries. Right, he had no experience dealing with a foreign country. Yes? I never thought of that. I always like it when somebody brings up something that I never thought of. That's like, then I know I've got a great group, you know? Overcome references in literature that sannyasi shouldn't travel overseas. Right. Other seeming contradictions. Like he had to stay in that house where they were keeping meat. I mean, he had to do things which were not exactly regular things for a sannyasi. Yes. What? He had to do everything himself in the beginning, right? Actually, for a long time in India, also had to do everything himself. Yes. Oh. No, living guru to guide him. Yeah. And think about it for a minute. Now, what instructions did his spiritual master give him? Whatever money you get, print books. And what else? Not in the West. Preach in English to English-speaking people. Now, he gave him that instruction twice. It could be more, but we know about twice. For one, when Prabhupada first met his spiritual master, when Prabhupada was about, I think, 22. And then another time, about 2 weeks before Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati left the planet. Srila Prabhupada wrote a letter to his spiritual master. He said, your renounced disciples are doing intimate service for you. I'm a householder. You know, what service can I do? And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati wrote back and he said, again, you should preach in English to English-speaking people. This will do good for you as well as the people who hear you. And sometimes, I mean, just recently, in fact, I ran into this. You have devotees who say, you know, unless Prabhupada, or Srila Prabhupada, unless Prabhupada gave an instruction very specifically, you know, you can't do it. But did Prabhupada get, I mean, Prabhupada considered that in order to become a Diksha Guru, by the way. I mean, when Prabhupada talks about, he said that was my spiritual master's order to go out and make disciples. And it was a very general order, wasn't it? And Prabhupada kind of did different things with how to do that. I mean, first he was writing an English magazine and was distributing in India, and then someone said to him, well, people throw magazines away. Why don't you write books? And he said, oh, that's a good idea. I'll write books. And he was remembering all my spiritual master said, if you ever get money, print books. And he was preaching to English-speaking people in India. And he tried to start a society in India. And it, at least externally, failed. It didn't work out very well. And, of course, he was thinking all along that he might want to come to the West. But that made him even more determined. I mean, by the way, we can think of this in terms of our own life. Many times when things fail, it's because Krishna is trying to push us into some other situation. We'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow. But then Prabhupada was thinking, you know, well, everyone's imitating America. Let me go to America. And my other god brothers failed in London. But Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati did not say to Srila Prabhupada specifically, you know, go to New York. Right? And no, he didn't have Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati right there saying to him, do this, do this, do this. And did he have a lot of help from his god brothers? No. I mean, in fact, there was so much fighting in the Gaudiya Mutt that he was getting contradictory advice from his god brothers. I mean, he had Keshava Maharaj was a help to him. He encouraged him to take sannyas after he got that dream from Bhaktisiddhanta. No, certainly. And for most other people, these things would be pretty insurmountable obstacles. Another thing that I've thought about that Prabhupada himself mentions is language. I mean, it took me personally about a week before I could understand Prabhupada's lectures on tape. And I would imagine that for many of you for whom English is a second language, it must be very difficult. I mean, the combination of Prabhupada's accent and the second language. But, you know, it took Prabhupada some time, of course, and Prabhupada was taught British English. You know, in the early part of the last century, which was not the kind of English that the Americans he was speaking to were speaking. And Prabhupada was speaking a different English. Sometimes the editors would have difficulty with this with the books, by the way. There are some words that Srila Prabhupada uses in his purports and his lectures which are not the way we use English in America. The editors run into this. Prabhupada uses the word impatient, for example, in a different way. He uses the word flavor in a different way. I mean, he uses old British meanings rather than meanings that were current in America in the 1970s? What to speak of meanings that are current now in America? I mean, there will come a time when Prabhupada's books will have to be translated into English if English is still around. Less like Shakespeare's books, you need to have little, you know, notes to read the English. And it's already, some of the English is already difficult, even for English speakers. So his accent was difficult, and even his English was difficult for Americans sometimes. All right, so those were definitely obstacles. I'm sure we could think of more. And each one of these was significant. I mean, I'm sure that for many of us, just one of these obstacles would have been enough for us to say, forget it. What to speak of two or three of them, yes. Okay, well, that's a good question, and I think before we go on, why don't we stop? I don't have that on my list, but I'll take this as a what we call in education, if any of you are educators, a teachable moment, because this is something that comes up. As I say, it's off the track, but I think it's important enough. When we come to obstacles, this is a question that comes up all the time. People ask all the time, how do we know when we run into some obstacle? Is it a test of our sincerity? Or is it Krishna telling you you're going down the wrong road? Now, some of these things, like, for example, the project in Jhansi, Prabhupada understood, not that he should give up his preaching mission in general, but that he should do it another way. So he did understand that it was a block, that Krishna was redirecting him. Another example was the failure of his business. So there are times when there's an obstacle, and it is a sign from Krishna that you're supposed to change direction. Now, sometimes you're supposed to change direction within the overall mission that you're doing. Sometimes you're supposed to change your focus completely. So sometimes it is that kind of message. And if you don't listen, the obstacle is going to get thicker and tighter until you move. You know, you're going to get kicked harder and harder and harder and harder until you change places, because you're not supposed to be where you are. So there are times like that, and where, in fact, there's a story like that in the Bhagavatam with Maharaj Prithu, that Maharaj Prithu wanted to perform 100 horse sacrifices. And he had done 99, and he got to the 100th. When he got to the 100th, what happened? Indra stole the horse. And Indra kept stealing the horse, but he was dressed up as a renunciate. But it was odd. Kind of like if we saw someone coming in and they were sort of dressed like a devotee, but not quite. You know, we weren't sure. Hey, devotee or what? You know? So we came, and it was like that. And one of the great rishis said to Prithu Maharaj's son, that's Indra, kill him. So Maharaj Prithu's son went to kill him, and he saw, I can't kill him. He looks something like a sannyasi. He just offered his obeisances. But when Indra saw that Prithu Maharaj's son coming with weapons, he got scared, and he left the horse and ran away. And this happened several times. And every time Indra took a new false sannyasi dress. And finally, you know, the rishis told Maharaj Prithu's son, yeah, every time you're doing this, Indra is starting another false religious system. You can't have this keep going on. So then they decided they were just going to kill Indra outright. But the priest performing the sacrifice said, well, the only way that we can kill anybody or anything, we can only kill sacrificial animals. So we're going to have to say a mantra to consider Indra a sacrificial animal and call him into the fire as if he were a sacrificial animal. So they start doing that. And then Lord Brahma shows up and he says, you can't do that. He says, this is a sacrifice for Lord Vishnu that's also meant to please all the demigods. And Indra's the chief demigod. all the demigods are almost considered part of his body. And how can you be satisfying Lord Vishnu and all the demigods if you're going to kill the chief one? He says, it doesn't make any sense. And then he says, anyone who tries to counteract some obvious obstacle like this enters into the darkest region of materialistic thought. So then, okay, when is there an obstacle where you say, oh, okay, you know, time to just surrender? Lord Brahma said, be happy with your 99 horse sacrifices and leave it at that. Just don't do your 100th horse sacrifices. And then Lord Vishnu came. You know, they already had all the paraphernalia, so they went on without sacrificing the horse. And Lord Vishnu came, and he brought Indra, and Indra was sorry, and everybody lived happily ever after. But so when do you know that you're going, if you fight it, you're going to enter into the darkest region of materialistic thought? And when do you know that it's a test? So I've come up with an answer. And that is, first of all, can you stop it? Do you have the ability to overcome the obstacle or not? Is it even within your power? Could Prahlad oppose Hiranyakashipu, who was running the whole universe? I mean, could Prabhupada fight against the government, I think it was a governor in Jhansi? I mean, could you do it? Could he do it? Sometimes they're just, you know, one good devotee friend of mine was diagnosed with cancer. So, you know, she had surgery, she had chemotherapy, she had radiation, then she tried all the natural cures, everything. Then there's nothing left to try after a certain point. Oh, now you're getting better. Now it's back again. Now you're getting better. Now it's back again. Now you're getting better. Now it's, at a certain point, there's nothing else to do. So the first question is, is it even possible for you to overcome the obstacle? Can you do it? So that we have a flow chart. Yes, no. So if the answer is no, then it must be Krishna saying, go another way. Okay. Let's say the answer is yes. I can overcome the obstacle. Then the question is your means of overcoming the obstacle legal? Is your means of overcoming the obstacle moral? Is it ethical? In order to overcome the obstacle, do I have to kill somebody? Do I have to rob somebody? Do I have to lie? Do I have to cheat? Do I have to steal? I mean, what do I have to do to overcome this obstacle? Do I have to destroy my family? I mean, what do I have to do? What will be the price? Is it spiritually correct? Let's say I've lost all my money, and, okay, I can earn money. I have some legal, moral, ethical means of doing so, but the only thing that's offered to me is some job that will ruin my sadhana totally. You understand? Sometimes the spiritual price is too high. So, you know, what's the price? So if I can do it, and if my means of doing it is legal, moral, ethical, if I'm not going to damage a whole bunch of people or things or project, if it's not going to damage my spiritual life, let's say if my means of overcoming the obstacle will make me more Krishna conscious, well, then definitely it's just a test. If my way of overcoming the obstacle is to chant better rounds, if my way of overcoming the obstacle is to become more humble and more tolerant, if my way of overcoming the obstacle is to become nicer to people, you know, then it's a test. If those are my means, but if my way of overcoming the obstacle is to be nasty to people, if my way of overcoming the obstacle is to stop sleeping and ruining my health, if my way of overcoming the obstacle is to desert my family, if my way of overcoming the obstacle is lying and cheating and stealing, then it's Krishna saying, no, don't do this anymore. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any further thoughts on that? Yes. You know, it's okay if I sometimes feel very blessed that I'm a native English speaker, and I'm so moved that so many of you who have English as your second language come to these programs where the medium is in English, and you're doing your best to listen in English and participate in English, and I offer my obeisances to you. Don't worry about it. Yes, that's very important. The why do I want to do this? Am I wanting to do it for myself, or am I wanting to do it to please Krishna? Yes. Yes, thank you. That is very important. Of course, the problem is that while we're in the process of becoming devotees, that we are going to be mixed in our motives. That is a problem. And when we look in our heart honestly, we are going to see, if we're honest, when we are very beginning devotees, we always think that all of our motives are pure. And the more we advance in Krishna consciousness, we are going to think that all of our motives are impure. So, yes. So sometimes that is difficult. And as we are advancing in Krishna consciousness, we'll see that our motives are mixed. But at least we should be dovetailing. At least we should be trying to. It shouldn't be all selfish, at least. There should be some desire there to please Krishna and to become purified. And generally, if it's something that's all selfish, but we're trying to be Krishna conscious, those are often the things where Krishna will be pushing us in another direction. Those are almost always exactly the things where Krishna is giving us some indication that this is not very good for you. There was someone else that had something. Yes? Then you see that Krishna is testing you, yes.
But personally, I found that the difficult time is often you can't see it. It's like a gray zone. Maybe, but maybe not.
You're not sure if you can overcome it or not. You can always try. You can try. I mean, like Prabhupada and Jansi, he tried. He did try. It wasn't that he immediately said, I can or I can't. He tried. Also, how much you try depends upon what is the gain. How much effort you're going to put into overcoming an obstacle depends, and what this nice devotee said also. You know, to what extent is this going to further my goal in Krishna consciousness? If it's for a very small gain, or if I realize this is really just for my own personal gratification, it's very little benefit in Krishna consciousness, why try so hard? But if it's for a great mission, I mean, Prabhupada was really, he could understand that the gain would be very great. It was worth putting a lot of effort into trying to overcome the obstacles. And Prabhupada worked much harder to overcome the obstacles in Juhu than he did in Jhansi. So, yes, how much effort we put into seeing whether or not it's possible depends on what is the possibility of gain and also what you're bringing up. Looking at our heart, seeing what our motives is. And I think we also should ask other people sometimes,
You know, not just relying on my own introspection, but what do you think my motives are here? Do you think this is the right thing for me to be doing? Any other thoughts on this? Yes.
Also, some people will say to go justify the means. Right? Some people will go to the legal activities and they will say but it's for a higher goal. And you've seen this in your home as well. Something that I...
That is, on rare occasions, that is the case. If the only way to preach is illegally, if you're in a Muslim country or a communist country where either you have to preach illegally or you can't preach, then that's true. Or if you're on the battlefield and Krishna's personally there and Krishna walks up to you and says, lie. Cut off Karna's head while he's fixing his chariot. But Krishna better be personally telling you that. Because generally speaking, the laws of morality were given by... Who gave the law? Where did the laws of morality come from? Where did they come from? Krishna. So who do they please? Krishna. So the point is, we're not following laws of morality and ethics because we want to be very moral, ethical people. So we can say, I'm a very moral and ethical person. We're following them to please Krishna. So if Krishna is pleased by doing something that's normally immoral, then we will do something that's normally immoral. So if Krishna is actually in the forest playing his flute and calling you to dance with him, that's fine. Then you can leave your husband and go dance with him. Hari Bol, yeah. But, otherwise, he says, no, go serve your husbands and live a moral life. Do you understand? So, if it's actually Krishna standing there playing his flute, then fine. But otherwise, no. It's Krishna who's given the moral codes for society. So we follow the moral codes for society not to be moral people. We're not interested in being moral people. We're interested in pleasing Krishna. And being a moral, ethical person pleases Krishna. But, the time will come when we're no longer bound by moral codes to please Krishna. That time will come if we follow the process and chant with that effect. The spiritual world, they only have two rules. You know what the two rules are in the spiritual world? Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, two rules. One positive, one negative. That's a very good, everyone guesses that. Close. Prema, you love Krishna, and don't envy. That's all. The only rules. They don't have a police force. Oh, thank you. Of course, they have a sense of moral codes. The gopis are afraid that when they're going to see Krishna, they'll get in trouble with their family. But that's not really a sense. That's just for Leela. You follow? So, unless you're in a very unusual circumstance. And Sanatana Goswami had to lie to the jailkeeper to get out of jail and go see Lord Chaitanya. Yes.
Not as far as I know legally. No. Dharma, yes. Legally, no. When he took vanaprastha, he had one daughter yet unmarried. And he says that that is a debt that you cannot get out of, to not get your daughter married. But he said, suppose I die, then Krishna will take care. So let Krishna take care. She never got married. Never got married. And Prabhupada talks about some instances in the Bhagavatam where people who renounced their family life even before their children were situated. There's several instances in the Bhagavatam where they took it as an emergency situation. But ordinarily, that is not done. Ordinarily, a person waits till their children are situated. But legally, I mean, there might be, but I've never heard of any. Prabhupada was very careful to do things legally. Of course, he did want devotees preaching like in communist countries or in Muslim countries where preaching would be illegal. And he was not opposed to devotees distributing books in places where book distribution was illegal. So in that sense, yes. I mean, Prabhupada wanted books distributed, and if book distribution or Harinam was illegal, he wouldn't say, well, don't do it if it's illegal. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu set that example, that if preaching is illegal, you challenge the legal system. But in general, Prabhupada wanted us, as far as possible, to do things legally. Okay, I have to, otherwise I won't get done. Okay, last thing here that we're going to go over is what did Srila Prabhupada do in his preaching that was really unique? And that's going to be somewhat related to the obstacles that he overcame. Okay, and I'll start with a few things. That he was working in many different cultures. And what he did was, in all these different cultures, he was able to transplant the essence Prabhupada, somehow or other, he was able to get the essence of Krishna consciousness and put it in all different cultures of the world. He knew what to transplant and what not to transplant. So that people in America, in China, in Russia, in Peru, could all take up Krishna consciousness. I mean, that to me is just unbelievable. And a few years ago, I was in Vrindavan, was buying some things for the deities, and there were devotees there buying other things, and they're all talking, 60 different languages. And I just kind of stopped for a minute and I thought, how did Prabhupada do that? And the cultures are different. I mean, they're different. We might think we all have the same culture because we say Pam Ho Agusp, and you didn't get that, huh? None of you write Pam Ho Agusp or please accept my humble obeisances, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. You don't write that, huh? So we might think we all have the same culture because we share some things in common, but we don't. If you travel around the world, you see devotees from different countries. They have very different cultures. But yet, we've all been able to take up the essence of Krishna consciousness. How did he do that? Amazing. Another thing which I found really amazing is that he was able to elevate so many, and some of you brought this up in the obstacles, uncultured, low-class people. I mean, we read about in the scriptures, Haridas Thakur elevated one prostitute. Nityananda saved, Jughai and Mudai. I mean, you've got Narada Muni saved one hunter, right? One, two, here and there, one, two, three, a few. We're talking about thousands. Thousands. How did he do that? I have no idea. I mean, that is unprecedented. It is absolutely unprecedented. There's nothing. I mean, can you think of any story in any of the scriptures? We can think of stories of, one. And it's amazing. One hunter, one prostitute, one drunkard becomes a devotee. And everyone's amazed. Wow. One low-class person becomes a devotee. Let's go see them. Prabhupada did it with thousands. All over the world. How did he do that? I don't know. There's just no other history like that. I mean, you'll find history, you know, Narada Muni preaches to 10,000 sons of Daksha at one time. But they were all sons of Daksha. They weren't all, you know, at the Mantra Love Rock Dance in San Francisco. So, I mean, these two things to me stand out as just beyond comprehension. And we simply have nothing at all in history, over millions and billions of years of history, of anybody being empowered to do this. At all. Another thing that he did was he did some standardization. And that's an S for those of you who are British. It is an S. Just pretend it's an S, okay? I'll explain. Thank you for asking. When you make it into a certain routine. So generally in Vaishnav history, I mean in temple worship, there's a certain routine, you offer the deity at a certain time. But generally in the history of the Vaishnavas, each Vaishnava has a certain program of hearing and chanting. Like say Bhaktivinoda Thakur would get up at midnight and he would write his books and then he would have his job. Each Vaishnava has their own program. But Prabhupada made a standard program for all of his disciples, didn't he? Here's a standard morning program that I want all of my disciples to follow. Is that interesting? Why do you think he did that? Interesting. Yeah, every devotee feels at home. It's part of making a worldwide society, isn't it? It's part of uniting different cultures. It's also because he's not dealing with people who were all raised in a certain way. And we find that sometimes other people from the Gaudiya Math who tried to preach worldwide, who don't do that kind of thing, they end up having a lot of trouble keeping people at a high standard. When they say to people, okay, you can become my disciple and just chant however many rounds you want and follow whatever program you want, they end up not having a high standard of followers. You understand what I'm saying? And Prabhupada understood that. He understood that I'm making disciples and followers from people of all different backgrounds, coming from all different places and all different cultures. I need to set a baseline program. Everybody has to do this. I mean, other people didn't have at initiation that you get up and say, I vow to chant 16 rounds, follow the... You just simply said, I'm being your disciple. Why did Prabhupada do that? He wanted it very clear. This is the bottom line. I mean, he made it very basic. And he brought it to five very, very basic rules. And then he gave us a standard program. Okay, everyone should attend Mangal Arati and Bhagavatam class and like this. As I said, these things that were always went on in temples. But it wasn't that, okay, everyone had to follow exactly this program for their own sadhana. And Prabhupada said, I expect all my initiated disciples to follow the same kind of program. He was making a standard. If you study about organizational theory, you know, how do you standardize things? You can standardize the output, the process, or the training. And Prabhupada standardized the training. And this was one way that he was forming a worldwide institution. It was a stroke of genius. Absolutely a stroke of genius. Which we see that other people who tried to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world have not been able to do. They just haven't picked up on it. Another thing that he did, and I'm doing this myself because I'm running out of time, because we ended up talking about that other thing, which I think was important. But another thing that he did was that he taught us everything. He gave us the highest knowledge. At the same time, he concentrated on basics. Right? He knew what mix to give us. We have the gulab jamun, but our main diet is rice and dal and chapatis, right? Our main diet is not gulab jamun. You all understand what I'm talking about? So we have the highest knowledge. We have the highest with emphasis on basics, and there were certain basics that Srila Prabhupada emphasized over and over and over again, such as four-layered principles, you're not this body, devotion to guru. I mean, there were certain things that Srila Prabhupada, you'll find certain themes of preaching that he just emphasized over and over and over and over again. He knew, again, preaching internationally, what needed to be emphasized to an international audience. And again, we find that other preachers, they don't understand this. Somehow they don't pick this up. How to have the right mix of ingredients when you're preaching all over the world. What I would request all of you to do is think of other ways in which Srila Prabhupada's own contribution, just on your own. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to be collecting homework or grading you or anything of that kind. But for your own edification, to take some time between now and when we get together tomorrow, 5 or 10 minutes, and think of some other things that you could add to this list of what was really unique. How is Srila Prabhupada really uniquely empowered in his ability to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world? How did he do what he did? What was really, really special about Srila Prabhupada? I mean, you could write many things that were special, that were there, that's there in everybody, every great devotee of the Lord, but try to think of things about him that were there that we don't find elsewhere. And I do have to end now. For my own sake, because I have to talk again in 10 minutes, and I need a break. So I'd like to thank you all very, very much. And again, if you want to look at the list there, what we'll be covering on the other days, then you're welcome to do so. Thank you. All glories to